Hi, if you're listening to this, you're probably in nursing school. I just want to remind you that nothing I say should be taken as medical advice, and if what I say differs from your program or your facility policies, please go with what they say. All right, this unit is Unit 4, Labor and Birth. And we're going to talk about the process of birth, the monitoring of the fetus and uterine contractions, interventions for labor, medications given during labor, the fetal attitude and categories of presentation, labor causes versus signs, characteristics and mechanisms of labor, C-sections, postpartum physiologic changes, and postpartum assessment. After I go through the outline of notes, I will do some question and answers for this unit. So first, I'm going to talk about causes of labor. Labor is caused by progesterone withdrawal because progesterone is the hormone that keeps things relaxed, and when it starts to go away at the end of pregnancy, estrogen comes back in and starts the uterine contractility. Signs of labor are Braxton-Hicks contractions, cervical changes, bloody show, rupture of membranes, a burst of energy known as nesting, some weight loss towards the end of a pregnancy, and some normal GI symptoms like emptying the bowels and stomach upset. Some key facts to remember about labor is there is false labor and true labor. And in false labor, contractions are going to be irregular and the cervix will not be changing. It won't be dilating or effacing or thinning, any of that. Things like showers, hydration, and rest can help stop the contractions of false labor. But if you do those things in true labor, they will not stop. So characteristics of labor. So labor has stages. Three stages of labor are: the first stage, stage one, goes from the start of labor all the way until it's time to start pushing. And in this first stage, there are phases. So the first one is the latent phase. And in this one, the cervix is between 0 and 5 centimeters dilated. Next comes the active phase, where dilation is from 6 to 10 centimeters. And at that point, the patient will be very ready and might be shaky, nauseated, and think they can't go on. And that is the beginning of transition phase. And that's anywhere from 8 to 10 centimeters dilated. And that's where stage one of labor ends. And stage two is from the start of pushing until the baby comes out. And the third stage is placenta delivery. So seems like stage one is most of the labor all the way up until fully dilated. And then stage two comes for pushing and getting your baby. And then stage three is the placenta. Mechanisms of labor include the descent of the fetus, flexion, which is the rotation and tucking of the baby's body, internal rotation and extension, and then external rotation. Those are the steps for the baby to make its way out. Oh, and one, I forgot, fourth stage of labor, which is the 1 to 2 hours after the birth of the placenta. The mother is going to have blood pressure checks every 15 minutes, and the nurse will not leave the room for at least the first 30 to 60 minutes because this is the timing for the most likely hemorrhaging. So the nurse will be checking the fundus, helping with breastfeeding, charting, and the patient might be experiencing intense tremors resembling shivers. And then we will be giving them reassurance and warm blankets, even though the warmth isn't necessarily, it's not about cold, but it's just comforting. And the goal at this point is to prevent infection and prevent excess bleeding. So I'm going to go back to those mechanisms of labor again. First is engagement. It's the mechanism whereby the fetus nestles into the pelvis. And so you can say engagement occurs when the presenting part reaches the level of the ischial spines of the pelvis. Descent is the process that the fetal head undergoes as it begins to go through the pelvis, and descent is continuous from before engagement until birth and is assessed by a measurement called station. Station refers to the ischial spines of the maternal pelvis, which are the narrowest diameter through which the fetus goes, and these spines are a bony prominence that can be felt on cervical examination, and they're denoted as a zero station. So anything above that would be a negative number, and we can say from negative 5, it will move by 1 centimeter at a time. So until it reaches the ischial spines, the baby's head or presenting part, and then at that point it will be at zero station. And then as the fetus moves through the spines, you will get +1, +2, +3, +4, +5. Anything above or any positive number is going to be closer to birth, and any negative number is going to be further away from birth. So that is fetal station. The next thing I want to talk about is fetal attitude. Attitude is the relationship of the fetal body parts to one another. The ideal attitude is flexion with a vertex presentation and cephalic presentation, which is head down. And the chin will be tucked down into the chest, making the pointy part of the head, which is the smallest diameter, which is also called the occiput, the presenting part, and that is the best chance for fitting through. There's also other presentations. So there's military presentation, which is the main wider part of the top of the head. It's slightly wider diameter than the occiput, and the chin is untucked in that one. Brow presentation is even wider, and face presentation is pretty uncommon, but it's also a wider point to be descending. So categories of presentation, they refer to what direction the baby's face and head are pointing in relation to the mother's pelvis. So they can be, the occiput is the presenting part, and it can be rotated to the right side of the pelvis, to the left side of the pelvis, or to the center. And it can also be anterior placement, where the baby's spine is in the front of the belly, the anterior of the mother, or it can be posterior presentation, where the baby is turned around, and when they come out, they will be face up, also called sunny side up. Anterior presentation is the ideal way, and occiput posterior presentations are the most common fetal malposition that we see. So in an occiput posterior presentation, the back of the head, again, is directed towards the mama's back. The signs and symptoms of an occiput posterior presentation will be intense back pain, hypotonic labor, dysfunctional labor pattern, an arrest of dilation, and an arrest of fetal descent. And not all of those have to happen either, but those are signs of a posterior presentation. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about how we are going to know some of these things. And that includes something called the Leopold's maneuver. And that is basically a method of palpation to determine the presentation and position of the fetus. And then that also helps locate where the fetal heart sounds will be found when we are going to be doing monitoring. So just a description of Leopold's maneuvers. If the head is in the fundus, you'll be able to palpate a hard, round, movable object. If you're palpating the buttocks, they feel soft and have an irregular shape and are more difficult to move. The fetus's back is going to be a smooth, hard surface, and it should be felt to one side of the abdomen. Irregular knobs and lumps, which might be the hands, feet, elbows, and knees, are felt on the opposite side of the abdomen from the back. All right, so fetal monitoring. The purpose of fetal monitoring is to assess the well-being of the fetus, and this is our only way to assess this patient. And the most common information we will have is heart rate. I'm going to combine uterine contraction monitoring with fetal monitoring because basically at the same time as we hook up monitoring for the fetus, we'll be doing electronic or physical monitoring of the contractions. So if we're going to evaluate uterine contractions, what the information we're gathering is the frequency of contraction, the duration, and then the intensity. And measuring the intensity varies by what type of monitoring because some don't measure this. So fetal monitoring allows an opportunity to intervene for the best fetal and maternal outcomes. And my reference is Contemporary Modern Newborn Nursing Care. And here it does say that for low-risk pregnancies, continuous fetal monitoring has not been is not the best practice for the best outcomes for mothers and babies. Intermittent auscultation of the fetal heart rate is better for someone who is low risk, and it enables the full mobility of the mother. It's low in cost, and it doesn't involve special technology. For a high-risk pregnancy, they will have different parameters for electronic monitoring. But on page 345 in the Contemporary Modern book, it does say that women who receive continuous fetal monitoring are more likely to have a cesarean birth or an instrument-assisted birth and do not have better outcomes than low-risk women who have intermittent fetal auscultation instead. So the least invasive fetal monitor is the Doppler, the handheld Doppler, and it's for auscultation of the fetal heart rate. And you will check the woman's pulse at the same time because if they're similar, you will need to reposition and probably find the fetal heart rate somewhere else. What we will be doing is listening for a minute or so before, during, and after contractions at intervals. And if anything seems off with the fetal heart rate, then we can increase the invasiveness of the monitoring. The least invasive contraction monitoring is by palpation. So the nurse will place hands on the abdomen and feel the softness of the belly. It should be a little squishy to start. And then as the contractions go on, the belly will get firmer. And it can be documented as a mild contraction, moderate, or strong. And mild would be getting as firm as, say, your chin, moderate, maybe a nose, and strong would be as firm as your forehead. And then the next least invasive fetal monitor is going to be the ultrasound transducer, which goes around the mother's belly with an elastic strap. And they use ultrasound gel and place the transducer where the fetal back is to hear the heart beat the loudest. Or it should be near the fetal shoulder, and that's where the heart rate will be loudest. It's easy to put on and take back off, but it also can slip off. It's good for intermittent fetal monitoring, but it is attached to a cord, and so the mother will be stuck in bed while that is attached. And then together with that, for the next least invasive uterine monitoring, it will be the tocodynamometer, which is a flexible disc that responds to pressure, and it also goes around the mother's abdomen. And then it displays onto a monitor the uterine contraction as a pattern on graph paper. And then if more information is needed or your hospital has this, there is wireless monitoring. This is relatively new. It uses electrode stickers instead of the ultrasound. And contact is very important. So the abdomen will be washed and then a little bit roughened. And then these electrode stickers will go on and they are water resistant. And it comes with a battery pack. And this method of wireless monitoring also gets a fetal ECG and the maternal ECG at the same time. And so we'll have information about uterine contraction, baby heart rate, and maternal. And it's got kind of like more information than the other external methods. And then finally, the most invasive is going to be internal fetal monitoring. The amniotic sac has to be ruptured for this, and it directly measures the fetal heart rate and the ultrasound, or the uterine contractions from inside the uterus. And so there will be a little probe that goes in beside the fetus into an area of where the pressure can be measured for the contractions. And then there will be a fetal scalp electrode, which will be placed onto the presenting part from the fetus, and it will be an internal fetal heart monitor. It's used when it's very important to have accurate intrauterine pressure readings to evaluate the stress on the uterus or to determine whether the contractions are adequate for birth. In cases of obesity or when oxytocin is being administered and they're not able to get information otherwise, some indications for electronic monitoring are previous history of a stillbirth at 38 or more weeks gestation, the presence of a complication of pregnancy, could be preeclampsia, placenta previa, abruptio placentae, multiple gestation, or prolonged or premature rupture of membranes. In the case of an induction of labor, labor that started with some type of intervention like Pitocin, if it's a preterm labor, a decrease in fetal movement or non-reassuring fetal status, if there is meconium staining of the amniotic fluid, which might indicate a problem, or if it's a trial of labor after a cesarean, TOLAC, if there is a maternal fever, any problems with the placenta, or category 2 or 3 tracings, which we are going to get onto next quarter, fetal monitor tracings. And the normal fetal heart rate we should see is between 110 and 160. Fetal tachycardia is a sustained rate of 161 beats per minute or above. Marked tachycardia is 180 beats per minute or above. And fetal bradycardia is a rate less than 110 per minute during a 10-minute period or longer. So interventions that we might do if the fetal heart rate is not reassuring, intrauterine resuscitation. So these are techniques. We could reposition the mother because the baby could be compressing the cord or the mother could be lying on her large blood vessels. So we would tip her hips so that she's not lying on her side, on her full back, and just tip her so she's lying a little bit on her left side. We could discontinue augmentation or induction medications to lower the intensity of the contractions, because when the uterus is squeezing too often and too close together, the fetus might not be getting perfused adequately. Give IV fluids to increase the amniotic fluid. That could also help increase the mom's blood pressure, which could increase the perfusion to the fetus. Maybe do a vaginal exam to see if something is going on. Maybe that birth could just be imminent, or there could be a cord prolapse where a piece of the umbilical cord would be being compressed by the presenting part of the baby against the mother. We could administer oxygen, and if this is needed, standard orders usually say between 8 to 10 liters through a non-rebreather mask, and this could help make more available oxygen to the placenta, but this is a short-term, last-ditch type of thing. It can't be left on for that long, and it shouldn't be done with oxytocin or labor augmentation. Basically, it's buying time to get to the OR. Okay, tocolytics. These are medications used to stop contractions, and the main one is terbutaline. It can relax the uterus. It's also called TURB for short. It's a sub-Q injection and it lasts about 20 minutes and it makes the patient feel like they've had a lot of caffeine with a high heart rate. And we will also notify the provider and let them know it's time for them to come and make decisions about the progression of this labor. And it may end up being an operative delivery, which is called cesarean section. Medications are next. And when medications are used in labor, fetal and uterine monitoring has to be continuous. So before medication administration, the patient should be educated about the type of medication, the route of medication, what the expected effects are, and the implication for the fetus or newborn, and any safety measures that are needed. And this corresponds with Chapter 19 of the Contemporary Maternal Newborn Nursing Care textbook by Laidwig. So the first type of medications are cervical ripening agents, and it's important to note that these are not intended to start labor, but it's for preparing for labor, and to educate the patient that it could be a long time from the time of cervical ripening administration until labor. So it could be 24 hours of the Cervidil and then another 24 more hours of misoprostol. And they will be in the hospital admitted, monitored the whole time with short breaks. So the first one is Cervidil. Its other name is dinoprostone, and its indication, it's a prostaglandin for cervical ripening and involved in labor induction. Considerations for Cervidil or dinoprostone, it must be a full term or medically indicated, inserted into vagina, and it can be left there for 12 hours. If it needs to be removed, in the case of uterine tachycystole, it can be removed. And you can take it out if contractions speed up or the baby starts to get low. Then we have misoprostol, which is also called Cytotec. The indication for this is it's a prostaglandin for cervical ripening, and it's also for management of pregnancy loss or management of postpartum hemorrhage after delivery. It's extremely cheap and effective. It softens the cervix and also impacts contractions. Considerations must be full term or medically indicated. It's inserted either into the vagina, orally or sublingually, any mucous membrane. It lasts for 4 to 6 hours, and again, it could cause uterine tachycystole, which is more than 5 contractions in 10 minutes. So oxytocin is another agent. This is the synthetic form of oxytocin called Pitocin. It's given if the cervix is already softened up or if contractions need management to become more effective. It's also given for management of postpartum bleeding. So it's a labor augmentation or management of postpartum bleeding. The considerations are for labor, it's a high-risk drug that requires more than one nurse to verify dosage and changes. It's given by IV on pump. And for postpartum, considerations are it's given after delivery for bleeding, either intravenously or intramuscularly. The adverse effects for Pitocin, oxytocin, are uterine tachycystole, placental abruption, or fetal demise. Next types are anesthesia or analgesia. These are types of pain management. Some non-pharmacological pain management is really important for laboring mothers because anxiety and mental state can increase pain. So things like walking, using a birth ball, or changing positions are non-pharmacological pain management. So for the pharmacological pain management, there can be IV or regional labor medication. And for delivery, there are regional, general, or pudendal. And for postpartum, there's going to be local anesthetic for pain management. So our IV pharmacologic agents are systemic medications, and one contraindication for systemic medication is myasthenia gravis, and they should instead get an epidural. And the purpose of pharmacologic anesthesia during labor is to provide maximum pain relief at minimum risk for the mother and the fetus. And it's important to know that giving medication too early might prolong labor and depress the fetus, but if given too late, it's of minimal use to the woman and may lead to respiratory depression in the newborn. Assess both patients and evaluate the contraction pattern and fetal heart rate before administering prescribed systemic medications. Okay, so our systemic IV pharmacologic agents include, the first two are butorphanol tartrate, also called Stadol, and nalbuphine or Nubane. And they're both opioids. They have similar methods of action and similar side effects. So I'm going to put them together and then I'll say the differences. So they reduce pain intensity in early laboring women. They both cross the placenta to affect the fetus. They have side effects of possible hyper or hypotension, drowsiness, dizziness, urinary retention, and then, of course, the possible sedation of the fetus or respiratory depression of the neonate if it's born within 4 hours of administration, although they can be reversed with naloxone or Narcan, it's called. So they are both to be used before active labor in the first stage, and they are long-acting and very sedating. Now, Nubane is less sedating than Stadol, but it can still cause the sedation of the baby at delivery. Next is Sublimaze, or also called fentanyl. The indications are it's a very short-acting, it's relief of pain, and it does give sedation as well, but it does not cross the placenta. It also has side effects of hyper or hypotension, respiratory depression, and new ones, muscle rigidity and bradycardia. It can be given once an hour, and its effects last only an hour. So it's good because if the mother doesn't like the way it feels, it will disappear within an hour. It's not given when birth will be happening within the hour. Next, we have analgesic potentiators, promethazine and hydroxyzine. And their promethazine's name is Phenergan, and hydroxyzine is called Vistaril. Those are brand names. The indication of these is to increase the effectiveness of analgesics when given with opiates. They decrease anxiety and control nausea and vomiting. The considerations are they can cause drowsiness, sedation, confusion, dry mouth, and dry mucous membranes, and of course constipation. Next, medication is the opiate antagonist, naloxone, Narcan. The indication is to reverse CNS depression and respiratory depression because of opioid overdose. And it can cause ventricular arrhythmias and hyper or hypotension and nausea and vomiting. Regional anesthesia and analgesia. These are the epidural or the spinal or the combination. For nursing role in administration, we're going to preload the patient with IV fluids, including a fluid bolus of 500 to 1,000 milliliters, because the biggest side effect of regional anesthesia is hypotension, and it happens quickly. We're going to check labs and look at platelets, because 100,000 is the minimum for use of regional anesthesia, and make sure that the signed consent is ready. Set the patient up, make sure they've emptied their bladder, assess their pain, take their vitals, and have them in position for the puncture. They can be lying on their side or sitting up. The epidural, what's important to know about the epidural is it works by volume and gravity. And it's estimated that 61% of all women in the United States receive an epidural during their labor. Epidurals are placed by anesthesia providers. And the nursing role is, like I said, giving IV fluids and assessing the patient and making sure they're ready. The advantages of an epidural are that it can be continuous and adjusted throughout the woman's labor. It also results in fewer adverse fetal effects compared to intravenous analgesia or general anesthesia. It can also allow the woman to rest before pushing. And most times the woman can feel the urge to push. And part of the reason for that is that the S2 and S1 vertebral area where the nerves are that provide sensation to the perianal area is less sensitive to the epidural. So the sensation of birth is often felt while the contraction pain isn't. And so because epidural works by volume and gravity, we will need to be turning the patient every 20 to 30 minutes to keep the nerves bathed in the anesthetic medication. If the fingers begin to tingle and become numb, we will be having the patient sit up to, again, use gravity to bring the medication down to the appropriate nerves. Then we have the spinal anesthesia. This pain relief is almost immediate, but they're going to be very, very numb all the way up to their level T4, so their thoracic 4. And it's good for C-sections, and it's often done in emergencies because it's very quick. And the needle catheter is not left in, like with epidural, so it can't be adjusted. So basically, you get your dose, and now you're numb. If the numbness goes up too high, it can interfere with breathing, and airway management might be needed. And then there's this the combination, which is a combination of the epidural and the spinal, and it's used in very out-of-control pain. It's good for rapid relief, immediate relief with the spinal part, and then the ongoing epidural. So one complication is epidural headache happens when the spinal fluid leaks through kind of a larger hole, and those women can only lay completely flat until that hole closes or is closed with a blood clot injection. Epidural and spinal considerations include checking for thrombocytopenia, informed consent, and getting that IV fluid bolus on board. And then during administration, positioning is going to be a special consideration. Keep them rotating like rotisserie chicken, using sterile technique around, and also, of course, performed by anesthesia provider. After the epidural, we have a risk of hypotension, and it's going to be important for positioning and knowing where the level of nerves that we're making sure are being bathed in that medication. And then they may need bladder management with a Foley catheter. They're going to have a harder time feeling those abdominal muscles for pushing. So we might need to use gravity or turn down the epidural. And then they will probably feel that delivery pain of crowning. And then, so now the pudendal block is a good option for pain relief if it's too late for other types. And that is a block right in the region of the vagina. And the anesthetic goes into the nerves there to numb that area for birth. And local anesthesia is often used after birth for the stitching of tears or episiotomy. Okay, and lastly, general anesthesia is going to be indicated for emergency cesarean birth, or if for some reason epidural anesthesia is contraindicated for a cesarean. And general anesthesia is not just done willy-nilly because it causes lower Apgar scores and higher incidence of metabolic acidosis for the neonate. And it's not indicated when the fetus is considered to be at high risk, especially in preterm birth. It needs intubation, a rapid delivery, oftentimes neonatal resuscitation, because the common fetal complication is fetal depression. And it's directly proportional to the depth and duration of the anesthesia. It can also cause delayed fetal bonding and a increased risk of postpartum depression, trauma, high emotions, and even memory loss in the mother. And nursing considerations for general anesthesia. The following interventions must be performed. Placement of a wedge under the woman's right hip. Administration of 100% oxygen for 3 to 5 minutes. Immediate administration of IV fluid. And provision of client education and reassurance. So I'm going to talk about C-section. There are indications. A primary cesarean would be indicated with cephalopelvic disproportion, which is a large baby and a small mother, small pelvis. Fetal distress, a labor that is not progressing, a failed induction of labor. For a medical condition in the mother, and if there is a placenta previa, and then of course repeat cesarean. The classifications, they are either scheduled or unscheduled. An urgent cesarean might be because of a breech presentation, and an emergent would be something like fetal distress. There's no time for surgical counts and safety timeouts for the emergent. It needs to happen as quickly as possible because hypoxia can set in within 4 minutes. The incision can either be vertical or transverse. Classical incision is a risk for increased blood loss, and it's rules out the possibility of a vaginal birth after a classical incision. The inside incision may not match the outside scar that you might see, so always ask or find out The low transverse incision is the safest. And for C-section, the pain management can be either a spinal or epidural. And they might use analgesics like opioids and NSAIDs after. And after, they may get an abdominal binder. And then early ambulation is important. And pillows for splinting the surgical incision and for infant feeding is important. So vaginal delivery with use of instrumentation to help get the baby out is called operative vaginal delivery. And that can be done with a vacuum assistance or forceps. And when the placenta is delivered, we will document whether the fetal or maternal sides presented first. So the shiny Schultz is the top, the fetal side, and the dirty Duncan is the red, meaty maternal side. Post-vaginal delivery, we will be doing maternal assessments every 15 minutes for 1 hour and every 30 minutes for another hour, and then hourly for 2 hours, as agency policy says. There will be assessment of the perineum, and we're going to be looking for, the acronym is REDA, redness, edema, ecchymosis, discharge, and approximation, if there was an episiotomy. Sims left lateral position is helpful to check down there without having the mother have to be spread eagle. An episiotomy is a surgical incision made by the provider in the perineal area. It can be midline or lateral. And then also tearing can be anywhere. It can be in the vagina, clitoris, in the labial area. A first degree tear is just through the mucosal layer. A second degree tear will tear through the perineal muscles, but not the anal sphincter. And that one will need stitches. A third degree tear will involve the anal sphincter, the perineal muscles, and the provider will make sure to do a rectal exam to ensure it isn't torn all the way through the anal sphincter to the rectum. Fiber, stool softener, and fluids plus ice packs are going to be important for all of these, whether they're... And then for the third degree tear, pelvic floor therapy can be helpful to regain function. A fourth degree tear is going to be all the way torn into the rectum, and this person may have poor stool control for life. They have an increased risk of fistulas, wound care, poor healing, and they are going to need ice, Motrin, stool softeners, everything. And then we're going to be giving a peri bottle for use for anybody who's torn or cut there. And then pain management, we'll be giving ice at first, and then sitz baths that can promote healing. And of course, topical agents for perineal discomfort. We have foams, sprays, witch hazel pads. We're going to ensure that the patient ambulates early. Use a small pillow on the lower abdomen for after pains. We will give an analgesic 30 minutes before breastfeeding, because breastfeeding will increase those after pains. For our postpartum assessment, we're going to use the acronym Bubble T, and that is breasts, soft, non-tender, not cracked, uterus, it should be firm, midline, and at the level of the umbilicus, bladder and bowels, bowel sounds, and bladder should be emptying, bonding, that should be happening with their newborn, lochia, the smaller, the better, not having an increase in bleeding or heavy bleeding. Episiotomy, we're looking for healing, signs of infection, making sure the edges stay approximated. Thromboembolism, they're going to be at increased risk of pulmonary embolism or venous thromboembolism. Emotional status, it's normal to be emotional and tearful, but we're looking for signs and symptoms of severe depression. Activity. Are they capable of moving? Then they should be ambulating and moving. We're going to be looking at their emotional state, checking for postpartum blues, which are normal. Most symptoms disappear without medical intervention within the first 2 weeks, and just making sure they're able to safely care for themselves and the baby. Postpartum depression is more intense. It's related to the hormones, the role strain, and possible chemical imbalances in the brain. And this does require psychiatric intervention. It usually occurs within the first 12 months postpartum, and these ones are not able to safely care for themselves or the baby. And we just need to teach with the family in present, that if they're just not enjoying the baby, if they're not enjoying this period, then call and they can get help. Another complication is blood loss. It should be less than 1,000 milliliters. More than that is considered a hemorrhage. And hematocrit should be checked. You might see a 2 to 3% drop if they lose 500 milliliters. And it should improve by 4 to 6 weeks. And they have an increased risk of thromboembolism for up to 6 weeks. White blood cells could be 25,000 to 30,000 until the end of the first postpartum week. And it's not concerning without other signs of infection going on at the same time. And then complications with C-section are infection, deep vein thrombosis, maternal death, pulmonary embolism, postpartum hemorrhage, fetal risks, and reactions to the anesthesia. So we'll be assessing for any of those. And the postpartum uterus is contracting, preventing hemorrhage, and that is what it should be doing. If there's a problem, then the uterus will not be clamping down and it will be allowing hemorrhage to happen. And so our interventions will be to make sure that we're doing uterine massage and doing that until the uterus is firm. And some medications that are going to be going on in this postpartum period are the rubella vaccine. If they were not immune before, it's a live vaccine, so it can't be given during pregnancy. And it's also teratogen, so the mother cannot get pregnant for 3 months after administration. And she may get a rash for 2 to 4 weeks after the injection. The other thing would be an intramuscular injection of the Rh immunoglobulin. It's given 72 hours after the birth in an Rh negative mother. The medications that we'll send home are going to be analgesics, including ibuprofen, Tylenol, possibly hydrocodone, oxycodone. We'll be sending home Epifoam, Tux pads, stool softener, and a contraceptive method. And we're going to teach the patient to keep everything out of the vagina until 6 weeks postpartum. And when ready to resume sex, they need to have a contraceptive plan so they don't come pregnant to the 6-week checkup. So for abnormal findings in the postpartum period, it will be a temperature above 100.4, hypotension, tachycardia, trouble breathing, elimination troubles, possible UTI or nerve damage, boggy fundus or lochia clots that are bigger than a nickel, extreme pain, and signs and symptoms of clots or thromboembolism. Some postpartum physiologic changes are going to be: the placenta site heals by exfoliation and growth of endometrial tissue. The uterine cells atrophy with decrease in estrogen and progesterone. The cervix and vagina returns to normal size by 6 weeks. There is some vaginal dryness until normal ovulation returns. In the perineal area, it will have a decreased muscle tone. There may be swelling, bruising, or lacerations. Start teaching Kegels by the 6-week mark. And then ovulation and menstruation resumes by 3 months for non-lactating mothers. And the vital signs that you might see: the blood pressure can have a transient increase but should start to decrease 6 to 10 days later. The heart rate will have a transient decrease for 6 to 10 days. The temperature may slightly increase, and they will have puerperal diuresis, which is a lot of sweating and peeing. They will have an increased bladder capacity. And then the weight loss that we will see will be at birth. They'll lose 10 to 12 pounds, 5 pounds in the first few days. And then supposedly pre-pregnancy weight can be returned to by 6 to 8 weeks postpartum. But of course, there's a big range in normal. Chills are very normal immediately after the delivery only. Anything else would be abnormal. The cardiac output declines by 30% in the first 2 weeks and will be back to baseline by 6 weeks. And that's directly related to the diuresis, getting all that excess water gone. Failure to diurese will lead to pulmonary edema because excess fluid. And the GI system, they may have sluggish bowels, constipation. If they had pain medication, that can be even worse. Walking is very important, and flatulence is normal and should be encouraged. They may have a fear of having a BM after the birth, and stool softeners are important for that. In the bladder, they could have bladder distension. If there's signs and symptoms of a boggy uterus, it could be displaced by a full bladder, and so we should be palpating that area and encourage voiding every 4 to 6 hours. And if there's no urine by 8 hours, consider cathing, either straight cath or Foley cath, and increase fluid intake. In the abdomen, the abdominal wall should return to pre-pregnancy state at approximately 6 weeks. Diastasis recti is the abdominal muscles separating in the center. Striae are those stretch marks. They should fade but remain. They're permanent. The linea nigra will fade away. And the return to the uterus baseline is called uterus involution. And immediately after birth, the fundus should be midline between the symphysis pubis and umbilicus. And then 6 to 12 hours after the birth, it will rise again to the level of the umbilicus because of blood clots. And then it will decrease by 1 centimeter every day down from the umbilicus. And it will contract to the size of a large grapefruit. And those uterine vessels will be firmly compressed and stop bleeding. And if the fundus is higher than expected or not in the midline, it may be misplaced by bladder distension or clots. And for uterine tone, we should be gently massaging the uterus, expelling clots, and making sure we're using that bimanual massage technique with 2 hands, one at the lower part to support the uterus, and at the top, massaging down. And then uterine atony is the failure of the uterus to properly contract after birth, subinvolution, and predisposing factors are prolonged labor, overdistension of the uterus with a multiples pregnancy or hydramnios, grand multiparity, which is 6 or more deliveries, or excessive use of analgesics or anesthesia, intrapartum stimulation with Pitocin, and or trauma due to obstetrical procedures. And lochia is the bleeding that happens after delivery. It is not a period, and it should be a small to moderate amount in the first few hours. It should not be heavy. Saturating a pad in 1 hour is going to be heavy. But in the first hour after birth, we will check the pad every 15 minutes to check how much blood is coming out. Okay, so that is finally the end of the content. That was a lot. And now I'm going to just spend some time asking questions and giving the rationales for the answers. And I'm not going to pause a long time. So you might, if you're going to listen to this and try to quiz yourself, you should probably pause. The nurse is caring for a client in labor. Which assessment findings indicate to the nurse that the client is beginning the second stage of labor? 1, the contractions are regular. 2, the membranes have ruptured. 3, the cervix is dilated completely. Or 4, the client begins to expel clear vaginal fluid. And the answer is 3. The second stage of labor begins when the cervix is dilated completely and ends with the birth of the neonate. The nurse is performing an assessment of a client who is scheduled for cesarean delivery at 39 weeks of gestation. Which assessment finding indicates the need to contact the primary healthcare provider? 1, hemoglobin of 11, fetal heart rate of 180, maternal pulse rate of 85, or white blood cell count of 12,000. And the answer is 2, a fetal heart rate of 180. A normal fetal heart rate is 110 to 160 per minute. A fetal heart rate of 180 beats per minute could indicate fetal distress and would warrant immediate notification of the primary health care provider. By full term, a maternal normal hemoglobin is 11 to 13 because of the hemodilution caused by an increase in plasma volume during pregnancy. The maternal pulse rate during pregnancy increases 10 to 15 beats per minute over pre-pregnancy to facilitate increased cardiac output, oxygen transport, and kidney filtration. White blood cell counts in a normal pregnancy begin to increase in the second trimester and peak in the third trimester with a normal range of 11,000 to 15,000. During the immediate postpartum period, the white blood cell count may be 25,000 to 30,000 because of increased leukocytosis that occurs during delivery. A client in labor is transported to the delivery room and prepared for cesarean delivery. After the client is transferred to the delivery room table, the nurse would place the patient in which position? 1. Supine position with a wedge under the right hip. 2. Trendelenburg's position with the legs in stirrups. 3. Prone position with the legs separated and elevated. 4. Semi-Fowler's position with a pillow under the knees. And the answer is 1. Supine position with a wedge under the right hip. The vena cava and descending aorta compression by the pregnant uterus impedes blood return from the lower trunk and extremities. This leads to decreasing cardiac return, cardiac output, and blood flow to the uterus and subsequently the fetus. The best position to prevent this would be side lying with the uterus displaced off the abdominal vessels. Positioning for abdominal surgery necessitates a supine position. However, a wedge placed under the right hip provides displacement of the uterus. Trendelenburg's position places pressure from the pregnant uterus on the diaphragm and lungs, decreasing respiratory capacity and oxygenation. A prone or semi-Fowler's position is impractical for this type of abdominal surgery. A client arrives at a birthing center in active labor. After examination, it is determined that the client's membranes are still intact and the client is at a negative 2 station. The primary healthcare provider prepares to perform an amniotomy. What will the nurse relay to the client as the most likely outcomes of the amniotomy? Select all that apply. 1. Less pressure on the cervix. 2. Decreased number of contractions. 3. Increased efficiency of contractions. 4. The need for increased maternal blood pressure monitoring. 5. The need for frequent fetal heart monitoring to detect the presence of a prolapsed cord. And the answers are 3 and 5. 3 is increased efficiency of contractions, and 5 is the need for frequent fetal heart monitoring to detect a prolapsed cord. Amniotomy, which is artificial rupture of the membranes, can be used to induce labor when the condition of the cervix is favorable, ripe, or to augment labor if the progress begins too slow. Rupturing of the membranes allows the fetal head to contact the cervix more directly and may increase the efficiency of contractions. Increased monitoring of maternal blood pressure is unnecessary after this procedure. The fetal heart rate needs to be monitored frequently as there is an increased likelihood of a prolapsed cord with ruptured membranes and a high presenting part. The nurse is assisting a client undergoing induction of labor at 41 weeks of gestation. The client's contractions are moderate and occurring every 2 to 3 minutes with a duration of 60 seconds. An internal fetal heart rate monitor is in place. The baseline fetal heart rate has been 120 to 122 beats per minute for the past hour. What is the priority nursing action? 1. Discontinue the infusion of oxytocin. 2. Notify the primary healthcare provider. 3. Place oxygen on at 8 to 10 liters per minute via face mask. 4. Contact the client's primary support persons if not present. And the answer is 1. Discontinue the infusion of oxytocin. The priority nursing action is to stop the infusion of oxytocin. Oxytocin can cause forceful uterine contractions and decrease oxygenation to the placenta, resulting in decreased variability. After stopping the oxytocin, the nurse would reposition the laboring client, notifying the primary healthcare provider, applying oxygen, and increasing the rate of the IV fluid are also actions that are indicated in this situation, but not the priority action. Contacting the client's primary support persons is not the priority action at this time. The nurse is monitoring a client in active labor and notes that the client is having contractions every 3 minutes that last 45 seconds. The nurse notes that the fetal heart rate between contractions is 100 beats per minute. Which nursing action is most appropriate? 1. Notify the primary healthcare provider. 2. Continue to monitor the fetal heart rate. 3. Encourage the client to continue pushing with each contraction. 4. Instruct the client's coach to continue to encourage breathing techniques. And the answer is 1. A normal fetal heart rate is 110 to 160 per minute, and the fetal heart rate should be within this range between contractions. Fetal bradycardia between contractions may indicate the need for immediate medical management, and the primary healthcare provider needs to be notified. The postpartum nurse is taking the vital signs of a client who delivered a healthy newborn 4 hours ago. The nurse notes that the client's temperature is 100.2 Fahrenheit, 37.8 Celsius. What is the priority nursing action? 1. Document the findings. 2. Notify the obstetrician. 3. Retake the temperature in 15 minutes. Or 4. Increase hydration by encouraging oral fluids. And the answer is 4. The client's temperature would be taken every 4 hours while awake. Temperatures up to 100.4 Fahrenheit or 38 Celsius in the first 24 hours are often related to the dehydrating effects of labor. The appropriate action is to increase hydration by encouraging oral fluids, which should bring the temperature to normal reading. Although the nurse would also document the findings, the appropriate action would be to increase hydration. Taking the temp in another 15 minutes is unnecessary. Contacting the obstetrician is also unnecessary. The nurse is assessing a client who is 6 hours postpartum after delivering a full-term healthy newborn. The client complains to the nurse of feelings of dizziness. Which nursing action is most appropriate? 1. Raise the head of the client's bed. 2. Obtain hemoglobin and hematocrit levels. 3. Instruct the client to request help when getting out of bed. 4. Inform the nursery room nurse to avoid bringing the newborn to the client until their symptoms have subsided. And the answer is 3. Orthostatic hypotension may be evident during the first 8 hours after birth. Feelings of dizziness are signs that caution the nurse to focus interventions on the client's safety. The nurse would advise the client to get help the first few times getting out of bed. Option 1 is not helpful and would not relieve the symptoms. Option 2 requires a prescription, and option 4 is unnecessary. The postpartum nurse is providing instructions to a client after the birth of a healthy newborn. Which time frame would the nurse relay to the client regarding the return of bowel function? 1. 3 days postpartum. 2. 7 days postpartum, 3, on the day of birth, or 4, within 2 weeks postpartum. And the answer is 1. After birth, the nurse would auscultate the client's abdomen in all four quadrants to determine the return of bowel sounds. Normal bowel elimination usually returns 2 to 3 days postpartum. Surgery, anesthesia, and the use of opioids and pain control agents also contribute to the longer period of altered bowel functions. The nurse is planning care for a postpartum client who had a vaginal delivery 2 hours ago. The client required an episiotomy and has several hemorrhoids. What is the priority nursing consideration for this client? 1. Client pain level. 2. Inadequate urinary output. 3. Client perception of body changes. Or 4. Potential for imbalanced body fluid volume. And the answer is 1. The priority nursing consideration for a client who delivered 2 hours ago and who has had an episiotomy and hemorrhoids is client pain level. Most clients have some degree of discomfort during the immediate postpartum period. There are no data in the question that indicate inadequate urinary output, the presence of client perception of body changes, and potential for imbalanced fluid volume. Note the strategic word priority. Use Maslow's hierarchy of needs to eliminate option 3 because this is a psychosocial, not a physiological need. To select from the remaining options, focus on the data in the question. The nurse is preparing to assess the uterine fundus of a client in the immediate postpartum period. After locating the fundus, the nurse notes that the fundus or the uterus feels soft and boggy. Which nursing intervention is appropriate? 1. Elevate the client's legs. 2. Massage the fundus until it is firm. 3. Ask the client to turn on the left side. 4. Push on the uterus to assist in expressing clots. And the answer is 2. Massage the fundus until it is firm. If the uterus is not contracted firmly, the initial intervention is to massage the fundus until it is firm and to express clots that may have accumulated in the uterus. Elevating the client's legs and positioning on the side would not assist in managing uterine atony. Pushing on an uncontracted uterus can invert the uterus and cause massive hemorrhage. So, for test-taking strategies, focus on the subject, a soft and boggy uterus. Visualize the situation and recall the therapeutic management for uterine atony. Remember that a full bladder displaces the uterus. The nurse is caring for 4 1-day postpartum clients. Which client assessment requires the need for follow-up? 1. The client with mild afterpains. 2. The client with a pulse rate of 60 beats per minute. 3. The client with colostrum discharge from both breasts. Or 4. The client with lochia that is red and has a foul-smelling odor. And the answer is 4. Lochia, the discharge present after birth, is red for the first 1 to 3 days and gradually decreases in amount. Normal lochia has a fleshy odor or an odor similar to menstrual flow. Foul-smelling or purulent lochia usually indicates infection. When performing a postpartum assessment on a client, the nurse notes the presence of clots in the lochia. The nurse examines the clots and notes that they are larger than 1 centimeter. Which nursing action is most appropriate? 1. Document the findings. 2. Notify the obstetrician. 3. Reassess the client in 2 hours. Or 4. Encourage increased oral intake of fluids. And the answer is 2. Notify the obstetrician. Normally, a few small clots may be noted in the lochia in the first 1 to 2 days after birth from pooling of blood in the vagina.
Clots larger than 1 centimeter are considered abnormal. The cause of these clots, such as uterine atony or retained placental fragments, needs to be determined and treated to prevent further blood loss. Although the findings would be documented, the appropriate action is to notify the OB. Reassessing the client in 2 hours would delay necessary treatment. Increasing oral intake of fluids would not be a helpful action. Test-taking strategy. Notice the strategic words, most appropriate. Focus on the words, larger than 1 centimeter. Think about the significance of lochial clots in the postpartum period to answer correctly. The nurse is monitoring a client in the immediate postpartum period for signs of hemorrhage. Which sign, if noted, would be an early sign of excessive blood loss? 1. A temperature of 100.4 Fahrenheit, 38 degrees Celsius. An increase in the pulse rate from 88 to 102 beats per minute. 3. A blood pressure change from 130 over 88 to 124 over 80. 4. An increase in the respiratory rate from 18 to 22 breaths per minute. And the answer is 2. An increase in the pulse rate. During the fourth stage of labor, the birth parent blood pressure, pulse, and respiration should be checked every 15 minutes during the first hour. An increasing pulse is an early sign of excessive blood loss because the heart pumps faster to compensate for reduced blood volume. A slight increase in temperature is normal. The blood pressure decreases as the blood volume diminishes, but a decreased blood pressure would not be the earliest sign of hemorrhage. The respiratory rate is slightly increased from normal. Test-taking strategy. Note the strategic word early. Think about the physiological occurrences of hemorrhage and shock and the expected findings in the postpartum period. This will assist you in directing you to the correct option. A client in a postpartum unit complains of sudden sharp chest pain and dyspnea. The nurse notes that the client is tachycardic and the respiratory rate is elevated. The nurse suspects a pulmonary embolism. Which would be the initial nursing action? 1. Initiate an intravenous line. 2. Assess the client's blood pressure. 3. Prepare to administer morphine sulfate. 4. Administer oxygen, 8 to 10 liters per minute, by face mask. And the answer is 4. If pulmonary embolism is suspected, oxygen should be administered at 8 to 10 liters per minute by face mask. Oxygen is used to decrease hypoxia. The client is also kept on bed rest with the head of the bed slightly elevated to reduce dyspnea. Morphine sulfate may be prescribed for the client, but this would not be the initial nursing action. An intravenous line will also be required, and vital signs need to be monitored, but these actions would follow the administration of oxygen. Test-taking strategy. Note the strategic word initial. Use the ABCs, airway, breathing, and circulation, to assist in directing you to the correct option.
And that is the end of labor and birth.